From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, a forum later this week looks at reframing the immigration debate.
Oftentimes people say, get in line, apply for a visa. Well, there's no line. There's, at most, technically you could argue, 5,000 visas available a year for unskilled labor. The waiting list for that is so long.
Later, why ecologically focused weddings are gaining popularity in Milwaukee.
And Wisconsin's new poet laureate, Margaret Rozga, says she used to create her poems by noticing how one thing looked like another. Not any longer.
Lately, it has been more a case of, I can't write a poem, I can't write a poem, I can't write a poem, I've forgotten how to write poems, what am I going to do? This is the way I identify, I can't write a poem, and there it is.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The fight continues in Washington over President Trump's proposed border wall and the national emergency he declared to secure funding to build it. But the border wall is only one element of a prolonged battle and debate over immigration in this country, both legal and illegal.
Another issue that is yet to be settled is the fate of people in the country legally with DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals status. The future of DACA, along with immigration policies that have separated families, will be the focus of a forum this weekend organized by the League of Women Voters. Ed Falone is an associate professor of law at Marquette University and a member of the Undocumented Students Task Force at that school.
He'll be on the panel on Saturday, but spoke ahead of time with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. He says the issue of legal immigration is sometimes overlooked in the public debate.
Oftentimes, it's about not blaming immigrants for failing to do something the law doesn't permit them to do, and by the same token, not punishing or criticizing immigrants for doing exactly what the law allows them to do. So it really does require an understanding of our system. Basically, legal immigration falls into four broad categories. Most legal immigration to our country is based on a family relationship to a U.S. citizen, someone already here, in some cases a permanent resident already here. But it's a nuclear family. We're not talking cousins. We're not talking aunts and uncles. We're talking about parents, spouse, children.
Not even grandparents?
No, not even grandparents. The second category of legal immigration is employment-based, based on particular skills. Usually it's an advanced education. We're talking about people with advanced college degrees, master's, PhD, or specialized job skills where there's an employer in the U.S. who has a job. They can't find qualified U.S. workers. Significantly, what is not included is unskilled labor. People who don't have a high school degree, much less a college degree, people who don't have specialized skills, all they want to do is come to the United States and work hard. Oftentimes people say, get in line, apply for a visa. Well, there's no line. There's, at most, technically you could argue, 5,000 visas available a year for unskilled labor. The waiting list for that is so long, you're talking 30 years before you even had a chance. So realistically, that lane is closed. Then you've got refugees and political asylees, and these are individuals who have a well-founded fear of persecution, and they're fleeing for their lives, really. But they only are qualified if in somewhat narrow category if the reason for their persecution is based on race, religion, nationality, their political opinion, or their membership in a particular social group. And that's where there is some uncertainty in the law whether, for example, women who are abused in domestic violence situations where the local police won't help them, whether they qualify as falling in a social group, or whether women in general who face violence in their home country where they're not protected, whether that qualifies as a social group. So there's a little uncertainty in the law there. And then the fourth category is we have this crazy lottery system where if you're from a country of low immigration, typically Northern Europe or Africa, then you can apply for a lottery and we take about 50,000 a year that way. All told, somewhere around a million, 100,000 a year come in through one of those four categories. The people at the border don't have the option of asking to come in as unskilled labor. That's not available. And They're trying to come in as a refugee and political asylee, and that is an opportunity under the law, and they'd like to try and make that case.
So are there quotas? I mean, I know in the past there certainly have been, whether they were official or not, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But, you know, certain groups were more welcome than others.
Well, we do have quotas, and we have two kinds of quotas still. One is based on the category. So only a certain number of adult sons and daughters of U.S. citizens can immigrate every year. So there's an overall cap on that number, which means if you're in that category, there's far more people applying for those visas than there are visas available. You may have to wait a couple years. There's also a second cap, which is a per country cap. And so there are some countries where there's a huge number of adult sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, the Philippines, India. And in those countries, because of the country cap, that's an additional limit to prevent them from scooping up all the available. So the wait in those countries, for example, the Philippines and some of the family categories, the wait can be 20 years. And that's what happens. Now, where there is no wait is political asylum. If you are present in the U.S., the statute says you can make a claim. And there's no limit on the number of people. We've been running around 100,000, 120,000 a year in that category. But there's theoretically no upper limit on that.
So refugees from, say, Syria, they could come here and apply. Any number could apply.
Yeah. If they get here, any number can apply. If they're in an overseas refugee camp, there's a vetting process. It's very lengthy. The State Department's involved, the United Nations Committee on Refugees, and there's an application process. And so that people who are displaced and in an overseas refugee camp, they get kind of matched up with a particular country, a particular community, where there might be, for example, a Syrian community in part of the U.S., and they get brought to the U.S. But that's a separate system. If you get to the U.S. on your own and you claim political asylum, then presumably you have a right to appear before an immigration judge and to argue that you have a fear of persecution based on one of these five categories. And if the immigration judge agrees with you, then you get a grant of political asylum and you're entitled to stay, move on to get a green card, and eventually be a citizen.
So what is happening at our border with Mexico? There are a lot of people who are coming to the border who are claiming exactly that. They're claiming refugee mm-hmm. status. They're claiming political asylum status. What seems to be happening there that seems to be such a political touch point going on that's different from, say, people coming from Africa maybe claiming the same thing?
Well, the situation has changed a little bit. The facts on the ground, you've got many countries in Central and South America where the rule of law has really broken down, and you've got armed gangs that forcibly recruit young children. And so parents initially were sending their children on their own to the U.S. just to get them out of that situation under the argument that their life was in danger because this armed gang that the government couldn't control would kill them if they remained and didn't join the gang. So the first part of this crisis was children arriving unaccompanied. And initially, under the Obama administration, there was some attempt to keep them in detention, but there was litigation and there's a court settlement where the government has agreed not to keep children on their own. There was also then you began to get families come together with small children fleeing this situation. And the question is, well, what do you do? Do you put the entire family in detention together? Do you keep the adults and allow the children to be placed with relatives or friends in the U.S.? Do you let the parents out? And I think what has changed now in the current situation is we have this phenomenon of the caravans where people in Central and South America have come to realize it's far safer to undertake the journey on foot in a group. Previously, being on your own, getting food, being safe from violence or robbers, exploitation, it was very dangerous to move on your own. And so what's happened is that they've now started to come in groups for safety's sake and have better access to food, medical care, et cetera. It made sense. But now they're coming in a large group. Theoretically, they should be able to present at the border and ask for political asylum. The Trump administration policies, we don't want to hear these cases. How do we deter them from asking for what the law provides? There's simply more people asking than we can handle. We don't have enough immigration judges. We could theoretically give them a court date and release them into the community and say, come back for your court date. The Trump administration doesn't want to do that. And they really, I think, have a policy of separating the families, making the situation of asking for political asylum so traumatic that they're hoping the word will get back to Central and South America, don't come to the U.S. It's horrible. And so they're really trying to use this family separation policy as a way of deterring people from making political asylum claims that under the law, if they arrive at the U.S. border, they have a right to make that claim. The law gives them a right that the Trump administration would prefer they not exercise.
Is this kind of deterrence happening with other groups, or is it specifically focused on Central and South America?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I think that if you talk to lawyers who practice in immigration law, they will tell you that every kind of visa, from tourist visas to student visas. I had a conversation with an immigration lawyer recently about a fiancé visa. A U.S. citizen wanted to bring his fiancé to the U.S. to get married here. Every kind of immigration visa, it seems the Trump administration is slow walking and trying to question and put obstacles into it. And I think that that's a very consistent strategy. Rather than try to change the law, which would require getting a bipartisan consensus in Congress, instead use the application of the law, which the executive branch controls, as a way of creating a different reality. And to be honest, people on the right of the political spectrum accused the Obama administration of doing the same thing when it came to choosing not to deport certain groups. And in fact, the DACA program, the Deferred Action Childhood Arriver or Dreamer situation, is really an example of the executive branch choosing not to enforce deportation against a segment that under the law theoretically should be deported. The Trump administration right now is doing the inverse, aggressively enforcing the law in a way to achieve their goals. The law stays the same, but the facts on the ground change depending on the enforcement priorities.
Have there been historical precedents for both ignoring deportation and allowing people to stay who probably shouldn't, and also throwing up the roadblocks that we're seeing? I mean, have there been times in our history where these things have happened?
Yes. Again, that's a good point, and I think the general public should recognize. In terms of not deporting individuals who technically have no right to remain, there have been many times over our U.S. history where, for example, people fleeing a natural disaster or a humanitarian crisis have been permitted to remain in the U.S. even though they had no lawful claim. Probably the largest group was after the Tiananmen Square uprising in China. We had a large number of Chinese students in the United States who all of a sudden their student visa expired, and it was felt they would not be safe if they went back to China, but they had no real evidence of fear. They've been in the U.S. for a while. There was no evidence they would be mistreated, but there was a general concern. And under the first President Bush, he issued an executive order allowing them to stay in the U.S. even though their student visas had expired. And eventually Congress came around and created visas for them to allow them to stay permanently. But that was another situation of a humanitarian situation where the executive branch said, you know, we're not going to deport you even though we could. And really the DACA program is similar in that way. It's the idea is that you have a segment of the undocumented population, about 800,000 individuals, who were brought to the U.S. by their parents when they were young children, and they have no right to remain here. But there's nothing in the law that allows an undocumented person in the U.S. to become lawful. There's no mechanism for that. You can't go from undocumented to lawful. And so they remain in the U.S. with no possibility of legalizing their status. That means that they can't work legally for an employer. It means that it's very difficult for them to own property because they can't buy a house if you're going to get deported and lose it. Their ability to pursue higher education is very limited because as non-citizens, they can't qualify in many states for in-state tuition or even federal financial assistance.
Technically, they're not there.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So, and this is really a population where their presence here, the median age for most of them when they were brought to the U.S. by their parents is 6 years old. They didn't participate in that decision. They're here. They're living their life. They many times have no memory of the home country where they were born. And in that case, there really is a humanitarian argument. It makes no sense to try and deport these people. And so that's what the DACA executive decision by the Obama administration was designed to do. There had been many attempts to resolve this with a bill in Congress, but it always got wrapped up with broader immigration reform. There was always some other issue. We still see this today. The wall question gets wrapped up with other immigration issues. This is an issue that, for some reason, Congress for the last 20 years, going on 30 years, has been unable to fix the law. And finally, President Obama said, well, we just will choose not to deport these people.
Looking at the other side, where you were talking about the current administration throwing up roadblocks, slowing the process down for all legal immigration or visas or whatever, what's the historical precedent for that? Has this happened in the past also?
There have been instances more prior to our existing statutes under older regimes. But, for example, during the Cold War, if you had someone who technically qualified for a visa but was coming from the Eastern Bloc, a communist nation, oftentimes you would find this sort of slow walking of the entry and sort of summary denials for obscure reasons, even though they were qualified under the statute. That's a little bit further in the past. And I think it really has been striking under the current administration. Certainly in recent decades, if the statute says your client is permitted to come to the U.S., your client qualifies, I think most immigration lawyers have always assumed then their client would get in. And this is sort of a new world. But again, if the Trump administration can't achieve its policy goals by convincing Congress to rewrite the law, the way they enforce it becomes a tool that they can use.
Just like the Obama administration, just like the Bush 1 administration.
Yes, I think so. I think this is a little bit different because it's one thing to stretch what the statute allows out of a humanitarian concern. It's quite a different thing, in my opinion, to use your executive power to try and punish or be punitive to people. And so the motivation certainly is not humanitarian. The motivation is we want you to not come because we want to send a message. And I think that's a big difference between the two situations.
This whole conversation has me thinking about our overall attitudes towards immigration and the fact that we are an immigrant country. We're a country of immigrants. I mean, I know where all of my people came from, and they did not come from the United States. Yeah. It's been a few generations back, probably the same for you. Have we always had such a difficulty wrestling with this idea of allowing new people to come in to where we came in maybe 50 or 100 years ago or more?
Unfortunately, I think that's true in our nation. And one of the panelists at the March 2nd event at Overno College is Rachel Ida Buff, who's an immigration historian who can speak very eloquently on this history. We as a nation have consistently tried to demonize different immigrant groups. And I actually think that the situation of the Dreamers is really eye-opening for many people, because here you have a segment of immigrants who are not U.S. citizens, they're undocumented, and yet really they're functionally identical to any other young person that I've ever met. I mean, they go to the same schools, they listen to the same music, they have the same social activities, they speak predominantly English, they have low crime rates, they have big dreams, they want to go to college, they want to pursue professional careers and contribute to society. They're very idealistic. To me, I look at them and I say, what's the difference between them and my own children who are born in this country? I see no difference. But yet in our rhetoric and in politics, you know, our leaders sometimes try to demonize immigrants and suggest they're very different. They're not like us. And whether you cast them as criminals or freeloaders or something, it's really just an attempt to deny their basic humanity.
It just seems to me that we have such an interesting relationship with the idea of immigration. I don't think anyone disagrees that a country has a right to its borders and to allow who they want in. But we also seem to never quite settle for ourselves what that means. Are we the Emma Lazarus, you know, the Statue of Liberty?
You're tired, you're poor.
You're yearning to breathe free.
There you go.
Yes, that one. Or, okay, no, we're full, and we're going to be really, really selective now. And we don't seem to ever find a middle ground, at least it seems to me.
Yeah, and it really does get to broader philosophical questions. Should the government try to identify the kind of people we should allow into our country, or is that hopelessly misguided, and should we just have a more open door policy and let the good people rise to the top? I mean, how do you anticipate who the next, you know, brilliant entrepreneur is going to be, or such? Sometimes the government's not the best judge of the best people. So let the free market for labors, if you will, operate. So I think there are many policy reasons why immigration benefits our country. Probably the most important one is it keeps our population stable and growing. We're not getting older as fast as countries like Japan or China, which are really going to face a crisis of elderly with not enough young people to support them. I like to think when I'm older and a home help aide is sent to help me in my home and I open the door that, you know, the person's not 90 years old. Right? We need to have young workers, and we're not having enough native-born to do that. The number of children and families continues to decline. So immigration has been a huge benefit for the United States compared to other countries. It keeps our population younger, our workforce stronger, and that benefits us as a country. But that's a policy question. We could decide, no, we don't want that. I just hope that the decision is made based on reasoned principles and not based on demonizing people and mongering fear among the population.
Well, Ed Filone, we could talk for hours about this and still not get it all settled, but it has been such an illuminating conversation, and I want to thank you for stopping by.
It's been my pleasure, Bonnie. Thank you.
Ed Filone is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School and a member of the Undocumented Students Task Force at Marquette. He'll be one of four panelists at a forum on immigration organized by the League of Women Voters of Milwaukee County on Saturday at Alverno College. He spoke with Bonnie North, and you'll find a link to more about the discussion at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now, and then how soon-to-be-married people are trying to incorporate green practices in the weddings they're planning. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We think of wearing white at a wedding, but how about green?
With the snow still flying and temperatures hovering below freezing, the wedding season is heating up. And one of the trends that's becoming increasingly popular is getting married with environmental sustainability in mind.
Around 100 people showed up recently in the midst of our cold and snowy winter to explore eco-friendly weddings. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz was at the expo as well. She introduces us first to the spirit behind the Sustainably Minded Wedding Expo on Milwaukee's East Side.
When Mary Beth Crescent got married, she instructed her guests not to buy new clothes for the occasion. She bought decorations at thrift and rummage sales, and Crescent says instead of generating loads more to be washed or wasted, each guest was allotted a single drinking glass.
Here's your jar, and we glued fabric on the lid so everyone had like their specialized jar, and we said, you get one jar, you break it, you lose it, you're not going to drink for the night. So everyone kept theirs very
clearly. Crescent says in the end, she achieved her goal. Like, she shared her wedding with the 90 people closest to her, and they created very little waste.
A normal-sized trash can that you see outside of a garage, it was maybe a fourth full, if that. Like, it was really exciting to see that. Even in recycling, we had barely anything. So
when she became facility rental coordinator at the Urban Ecology Center on the city's east side, just above the Milwaukee River, Crescent says she carried an image in her head.
In 1 year of average American weddings total in the United States, the amount of waste that is produced is the same weight as the Empire State Building. And like, after I heard that, I was like, whoa. That's a lot. That's so much. Where does it go? Like, that just, it blew my mind.
The Urban Ecology Center is dedicated to engaging people of every age in nature and is also a popular wedding venue. The place is teeming with green. No styrofoam or plastic allowed. Every bit of food waste is composted. And Crescent says,
we flush our toilets with rainwater.
That level of green is unattainable for most wedding venues. But Crescent insists, no matter the setting, you can drive down wedding waste. To spread her philosophy, Crescent handpicked 17 eco-minded vendors.
They all have some eco-minded practice that they are doing or trying to do or like working on doing.
They converged at the expo. With live violin music wafting through the air, 100 people checked out the vendors, sipping brandy old fashions and non-alcoholic berry punch. One booth belonged to the Center for Biological Diversity, where Sarah Bailey shared her two cents on stresses that weddings can exert on the environment.
The two biggest components being travel, like where your wedding is and where all your guests are going to have to travel to, and food.
You can calculate the impacts of your projected travel and menu choices by using an online wildlife-friendly wedding guide Bailey's team designed. But her message doesn't end there.
It also goes along with our endangered species condoms.
Yes, Bailey said condoms.
The connection there is, stay with me.
She says the choices humans make, including family planning, impact the planet's health.
It's a way to get people talking about how family planning is good for the planet, because the more people we have on the planet, the less space and resources are left for endangered species. So the condoms, they have funny phrases on them, or the packages do, like, before it gets any hotter, remember the sea otter. And the condoms are vegan and fair trade, so sustainable.
A rose to have a really straight 2-foot-long stem.
Not far away, native flower expert Michaela Rosenthal was holding a workshop. A room full of people wanted to learn about the art of creating sustainable wedding bouquets. Rosenthal flashes images of her favorites on a screen.
10 of my favorites are just here. Black-eyed Susans and brown-eyed Susans. Has anyone ever heard of those before? Yeah, Rudbeckia. Yeah, good, good. They last for weeks. For weeks. And many people have them in their very own garden. Okay? Blazing Star, this is sold a lot in the horticulture industry. Usually it's not the native one that's sold.
If you're having a winter wedding, Rosenthal suggested alternatives to flying flowers in from far-flung places.
We actually have some really beautiful options that come from our native landscape. Winterberry has white flowers in the summer months. In the fall, the berries form and turn this brilliant red, and they hold all winter long. They're beautiful additions to bouquets. Don't be afraid to also use conifers. Evergreens are also really beautiful, really striking in the wintertime. Why not use our natural green?
Bride-to-be Leslie Peckham was looking for advice. She's getting married next December. Between now and then, she wants to start growing her own flowers and then dry them. Peckham asked Rosenthal,
which flowers are good picks that dry nicely and not fall apart? What do you think?
Yeah, dry them, pressing them flat, and keeping them in a cool, dry, and dark area, their colors will last.
Okay.
And then what you can do...
Peckham says she and her fiancé also plan to make fire starters out of pine cones to give to their wedding guests.
I was always sort of a nature-oriented kid. I loved being outside. I loved the natural world. And so doing something that honored that for our day was like just seemed like the right thing to do. Bring our values into the celebration in the ways that we can.
The expo wasn't only about flowers, food, and family. Vendor Cassandra Morello approaches an eco-friendly wedding from a different angle. The beauty expert advocates an animal-friendly and vegan palette. Morello asserts that makeup makes an environmental statement and impacts the planet.
Non-vegan cosmetics would be carmine is a common one. It's crushed beetles that gives that red pigment to a lot of lipstick, blush, whether it's red, purple, or brown. So that's something to look out for. Another thing is lanolin.
It's extracted from sheep's wool.
If you'd like to avoid having, you know, sheep oil on your face, that's a good reason to go cruelty-free, I think.
Nearby, photography team Michelle and Patrick Strom feel so strongly about the impact of what we eat that they were offering couples who plan to serve a vegetarian or vegan menu a substantial discount.
It comes down to environmental reasons, health reasons, ethical reasons. And as wedding photographers and anyone who works in the wedding industry, you will see at the end of the day there's so much food that goes to waste, unfortunately. And if that's all animal, that's just really unfortunate.
Animal products were not off limits one booth away, where Nina Mendez, with a catering company called Tall Guy with a Grill, was serving up dates stuffed with cream cheese wrapped in bacon.
People smell bacon and they come right to our booth, so it works out really nicely.
That doesn't mean the caterer doesn't have an environmental soul. Mendez says they source ingredients locally or as close to local as possible, and the kitchen has a no-waste policy.
If we order too many cucumbers that we don't use, we're going to make pickles. If we have fruit, we're going to make jam, like that sort of thing.
And the food waste problem we've heard so much about, Mendez says not to worry.
We actually collect that at the site, at the venue, and then we bring it back to our shop.
Then Mendez says the waste is composted. David Gackstetter and Tracy Wilcox's wedding is coming up next September. They made their way through the entire expo and seemed at the moment to be teetering on the edge of oversaturation.
Today we were really here for florals and kind of the music scene. So florals, we had a really great talk and learned a lot about what was like in season, out of season, all of the logistics that go into the flower business.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Never even thought about all the transportation and stuff.
Yeah.
So I've been learning a lot, and it's making me feel better now. And
makes you feel better because you're more aware.
Yeah, more aware. Yeah. And now I'm glad that we're not just doing a bunch of waste stuff we're going to throw away at the end of it.
The couple is figuring out how the day of their dreams can create more joy and less waste. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Benz.
You can read more and see photos of the Green Wedding Expo at the Urban Ecology Center at WUWM.com.
One more break and then a conversation with Wisconsin's newest poet laureate, Margaret Rozga. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Margaret Rozga has been a force for social justice in Milwaukee for more than half a century. She marched in the streets in 1967 for fair housing, and she has never stopped fighting for social justice in our city. But Rozga is also an accomplished poet, a creative pursuit that is both fed by her activism and separate from it.
Rozga is a professor emerita of English at UW-Waukesha, and her books include Pestiferous Questions, A Life in Poems, a biography of activist and writer Jesse Benton Fremont she wrote in Narrative Poems. She also edited the anthology Where I Want to Live, Poems for Fair and Affordable Housing, and contributed a poem as well, which we'll hear later in our interview.
Last month, Rozga was appointed Wisconsin's newest poet laureate, and she joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio to talk about this latest chapter in her life.
Margaret Rozga, Peggy, it is such an honor to have you back in the studio. Congratulations on your new appointment.
Thank you so much. It's been a real thrill. I can't wait to start poeting around the state.
Poeting. I love that as a verb. That's wonderful. this appointment, it's a terrific thing. I just love the fact that Wisconsin has a poet laureate. That is just such a grand thing to begin with. Has poetry been with you as long as your social activism, or is it something that was earlier or later?
It was probably both earlier and later. It was one of the things that I loved in school. The first poem that I ever really loved was Gerard Manley Hopkins' Spring and Fall, and for totally non-poetic reason, it begins Margaret. Oh, he has an accent on the last syllable. Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove on leaving? You, like the things of man, with your fresh thoughts, care for, can you? And I thought, oh, he's talking to me. So I began with this idea of poetry as intense and deep conversation. Probably lost track of it for a while, but never entirely. And certainly in the last 20 or 30 years, it's been an area of concentration.
Do you remember the first poem that you had to memorize in school?
I do. I had this wonderful English teacher my junior year in high school, and she had the class memorize poems and recite them together. And that's how we would begin class. One student would say the name, another student would say the author, and then we'd all say it together. So, Emily Dickinson, "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public like a frog to sing your name the livelong day to an admiring bog."
Mine was The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. I think it was in the fourth grade, and I had to learn the whole thing. However many gazillion stanzas
it was. Yeah,
but I can still remember, you know, the 18th of April in 75, "Hardly a Man Is Now Alive Who Remembers That Famous Day and Year." Yeah, there was something about learning the cadence and learning language in that way that was so different from just reading a book.
Right.
And obviously it spoke to you from a very early age.
Because I've retained it all these years. Actually, a previous poet laureate, Kimberly Blaser, that was her project, the term that she was the poet laureate. She had people who had memorized a poem, I say committed to heart, recited, and she recorded it. Now, on the Poet Laureate website, there is a map of Wisconsin and dots where somebody recited a poem for her, and you can click on it and hear it. And people ask me, well, if I want to get a start with poetry, if I haven't really read anything since Shel Silverstein, where do I go? And I think that's a great place to go, because you hear it. You hear the words, you hear the wonderful sound effects as somebody who cared enough about this poem to learn it says it. So I highly recommend that.
There's something so human about it, about telling each other a story that way, I think. And I think it's why children react to it so strongly.
Yes. Almost everybody that I've talked to has recalled a poem from their childhood. Well, and also the rhythm and the repetition and the fact that it connects to something that is going on in your life. My daughter remembers a poem called Homework. "Homework, oh homework, I hate you, you stink."
I think we can all relate to that, no matter how old we get.
Yes.
Yeah. How does your poetry come to you? Does it just sort of appear in your brain or in your heart? How does it happen for you?
It used to be that I would have some sense of one thing being like another. I never made a poem out of this particular thing, but it's the only example I can think of right now. I was driving in my car one day, and I saw from the side angle of somebody's house what looked to be a large playpen in the back of their house. Well, it was their patio. So here's this patio playpen. I never turned it into a poem, but that kind of perception that one thing looks like another used to be the way poems started for me, because I think that metaphor is really important to poems. Lately, it has been more a case of, I can't write a poem, I can't write a poem, I can't write a poem. I've forgotten how to write poems. What am I going to do? This is the way I identify. I can't write a poem, and there it is. Actually, this was in a history book that I read, not a textbook, but a book of history. It was the author talking about having written the book, and he says, if you write, the words will come.
So it's the act of actually putting pen to paper.
Yes. Yes.
And do you still write by hand, or do you do it on the computer?
I mostly get started by hand. I keep a journal. I call it an observation journal. I try to write every morning 13 observations, and they don't have to relate to one another. And I'm not trying to write a poem. I'm just trying to practice seeing, which I think is important to a poem, to everybody, but to a poet. And sometimes that will turn into a poem. It is the act of writing, right, that gets it going. So I usually start on paper, not always from that morning journal entry. Sometimes I wake up in the morning with a phrase in my head and I think I've got to do something with this.
To put a collection together for you, and I imagine this has a lot to do with the collection of poems that are going to go into it, but about how long does it take you to get a collection that you're happy with?
A long time. My last book, Pestiferous Questions, A Life in Poems, came out in 2017, and I probably started writing poems that would eventually make their way into the book in 2012 or 13. And then it took a while to realize, oh, I can keep going with this. And then it took several read-throughs and lining things up to work with each other.
So it's not a fast process.
It is not. Not for me. There may be some people for whom at least a given project goes quickly, but no, it hasn't happened for me.
Well, earlier you were talking about cadence and rhythm, which are, of course, are so important to music and poetry, which to me, they're sort of hand in hand. They're sitting right next to each other. I think of cadence and rhythm, and I think of marching, and I think of activism, and I think of going into the streets, and the idea that those two things are somehow connected for you as well, that there's the cadence of the marching, there's the rhythm of the kind of speech where you're asking and demanding change. And also the poetry as well. Or do you find them to be two different parts of you?
Oh, I think that's wonderful. I think you're on the verge of a poem.
You have to write it for me.
I hadn't thought about that. But the rhythm is one of the things that I think about when I'm revising. Sometimes in the first draft, the wording is clunky and not rhythmical, and getting that flow, that momentum going is one of the things I think about. But I never quite made the connection with being on the march. I love it.
Well, it's a kind of, I mean, poetry is a communication, but so is the activism.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my first book is about the marches. It actually started when the theater director at the time at UW in Waukesha, where I was teaching, he told me that I would write the play that he was going to produce that year. He wanted it to be on the theme of race and racism because that's what the Campus Read book was. And so I tried to do this. What helped me was that I was at a gathering with other people who had been involved in the Youth Council, and they knew that I was supposed to write this play. So they started telling me their stories. And I woke up the next morning, and I could hear their voices. So before I got dressed, before I had breakfast, I went to my computer, and I started to type everything that I could remember them saying. And then they became characters in the play, and a lot of what they said made its way into the play. And then after that was over, the play had a couple of productions outside of that initial one. But producing a play is expensive. You need a director, you need actors, you need a venue, you need tickets. And I thought, you know, these are almost poems the way they are, because a lot of it was monologue. If I would put it into poems, I could do it myself. I could just read the poems, or I could invite audience members to read parts with me. And so that's what I did. And that was the first I really tried to do a book of poems. And then I was amazed that it took me 40 years to write about something that was so important to my life.
In a way, I'm not surprised, because it was that important. It takes a while, I think, to process something that enormous, something that huge.
Yes.
I would be surprised if you could have done it a year or two after.
Yes. You do need that kind of mellowing time, that kind of reflection time, although I hadn't been thinking too much of, well, I guess I was. It was always part of me. I did think about it.
It's there.
Yeah.
You might not be conscious of it, but sure. Yeah, it's there. It's ruminating,
yes,
which is one of my favorite words when it comes to art making of any kind. Well, that's an obvious way that your activism and your poetry overlapped and informed each other. Do they do it in other ways? Do those two parts of you meld in other ways in your work? Or do you kind of have different things that you talk about in both places?
I think having written 200 Nights and One Day is that now I am alert to the possibility that what is happening in front of me is a poem, and it is, in a sense, being written for me. I just have to do the pen on paper or the keyboard or whatever and get what I am seeing and hearing and feeling.
It sounds like they're even closer now,
those two
parts of you.
Oh, yeah, they definitely are, right, yeah. One of the poems that I wrote most recently was a poem about the people who participated in the sing-alongs, the solidarity sing-alongs in the Capitol building. And I didn't know I was going to do this. I kept thinking, people say breaking news, and you see it scroll along the bottom of your TV or interrupt a broadcast with the breaking news. And that struck me as being such an odd phrase, breaking. And then if you switch the words around, news breaking, breaking news, news is broken. So I was just playing around with that. And then I thought, we were getting a lot of news of things breaking, broken, and they kept singing. And so that was the continuity. So that became a poem.
I love the idea of singing as a way of healing broken things.
Yes. Yes. Well, singing was always so important to the civil rights movement. And you can tell the history of the civil rights movement and the songs that came from this place and that place. And Milwaukee added some to the repertoire.
Have you ever written song lyrics?
I was at a workshop once where one of the presenters was a songwriter, and she talked us through writing songs. She played a melody for us on her guitar, and she kept humming it over and over and over and over while we were writing. And, I mean, that was a case where that melody, that rhythm led to, well, you had to say the next word because it fit.
But a different process.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. People talk about sometimes song lyrics are poetry or at least poetic. But they are not the same thing as a poem.
Yes, well, that debate certainly came up when Bob Dylan got the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes, it did. And there are a lot of people who think his work is absolutely poetry, mm-hmm. and other people who don't. And, you know, and there are other songwriters that I would say, well, no, I would never nominate that person. Great songs,
yes,
but not poetry.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but I think he definitely blends in there. He crosses both lines.
He makes the question a difficult one.
Yes, he does.
Yes.
Yes, he does. Well, now that you are going to be our poet laureate for a couple of years, right? That's right.
Yeah. Two-year term.
And Kim Blazer, who came in here a couple of years ago when she was appointed, you mentioned her earlier about what she had done, one of her projects during her time. What do you hope to accomplish in the 2 years that you are going to be wearing this hat?
Well, I would like to see poetry become a matter of ordinary conversation. When you are with other people, maybe people you don't know, and you're looking for some common ground, one of the things to have you read any good books lately? Have you seen a good movie lately? What poem do you remember and like? In fact, I've started to ask people that, which may lead to my next comment. Do you have a favorite poem, at least for today?
Do I? Oh, my goodness. There are so many wonderful poems. I have to say, I can't pick just one, but it is one poet, and that's Mary Oliver. Two of her probably most famous poems, but they're famous, I think, for a reason. They're so wonderful. One's called The Journey, and one is called Wild Geese. And they're both about going into the world and being yourself, finding yourself and not being afraid to do that, to live your life as fully as you possibly can, to not accept someone else's or society's restrictions on who you are or should be?
Yes. I often had students who would discover Mary Oliver and just really get deeply into her work. I used to use as a writing prompt, a line from Mary Oliver, "There's only one question, how to love this world." She has a really cool way of working the more abstract concept or line into the middle of her poem, and then it's surrounded by all this wonderful detail.
You have to go into the center.
Yes.
Which, of course, is a wonderful metaphor.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
But there are so many other poets that I love. Elizabeth Bishop was a poet that I absolutely loved. Rilke, in translation, I can't read German well enough to read him in German, but a good translation. There's something about Rilke that is just lovely. And his letters to a young poet, those wonderful letters that came out in anthology about 40 years ago, were a part of and still are a part of my bookcase. You know, I haven't read them in a long time, but so important, so important. Which leads me to my last question, which is, why is poetry so important?
It enriches our lives. It's our heritage. It's some of the best things that people have thought over the course of the ages and are thinking right now and will think tomorrow night and next week. And we want to claim that heritage. We want it to be part of who we are, be part of the way that we look at the world, help to shape our thinking.
Margaret Rosgo was recently appointed to be Wisconsin's next poet laureate, a post she'll hold for 2 years. She spoke with Bonnie North in January. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.